Lectionary Lab Live is recorded by Two Bubbas and a Bible, live from Gainesville, Florida, and Brasstown, North Carolina. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Hey, man. Good to hear you this week and get up with you. We're going to talk some text. We're going to talk about preaching. I try to think of something original to say every week, but this is what we do, and I think everybody listening knows. We love these texts. We love the task of preaching. And we really appreciate those of you who are preparing this week, whether you are formally a pastor, whether you're a lay preacher, whether you're teaching, or whether you just enjoy these texts as we do. These are the texts for the 25th Sunday after Pentecost, November the 11th, 2018. For those of us here in the U.S., November the 11th pops up as a significant date. Sort of back to one of those things that's not a religious holiday per se, but it is very religiously observed by many. And I know you were thinking a little bit today, Bubba, about the fact that it's Veterans Day in the U.S. And then we've got some text, so have at it, my friend. What about it today?
Well, yeah, Veterans Day. It was actually Armistice Day and Remembrance Day up until after World War II, in which some of the veterans said, why don't we just make it a day to honor all veterans? Mm-hmm. One thing, most of you know this, but some people get confused. It needs to be separated out from Memorial Day. They tend to run together. Memorial Day is when we remember those who died. Veterans Day is when we honor those who served.
All who have served. Absolutely.
All who have served. And it was originated. This is the significance for this day. It's the 100th anniversary of the first armistice, in which on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, the treaty ending the Great War, as it was known then, was signed in there in France. It was theoretically a war to end all wars. Not so much.
Nobody appended it World War I at that point because, as you say, we thought surely this is as maybe this is as bad as it will get. How could we have a battle worse than this?
Yeah. And it got worse. When the war to end all war is not so much, you might say Psalm 146:3, do not put your trust in princes and mortals in whom there is no help. It's kind of the pessimistic point of view, is a recognition of war is a recognition of our failure over and over again to figure out how to get along. Mm-hmm. So that's part of that day. And I know that for many that they'll be aware of that and you need to deal with it probably in some way or the other, that anniversary. And so there's one theme that could be picked up for that day. And there's some themes of service and sacrifice that kind of flow through here in all the texts. You have the widow of Zarephath making a sacrifice on behalf of Elijah. And you have the gospel lesson with the widow's mite and her giving her all. I mean, I think some of those are taking the text out of context a bit in terms of true exegesis. But, there are those pieces. And, of course, Christ's sacrifice. So at least those are some themes that might be picked up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But moving to the larger theme just of the – if we took these texts and they weren't falling on such a day so close to Veterans Day, how would we treat them is an important question. You push the day aside for a minute. We have the widows throughout. Other than Hebrews, we have all these widows to deal with. And that's an interesting context. You got the widow Zarephath dealing with Elijah. You've got references in the Psalm 146:9, he upholds the orphan and widow. And then, of course, the gospel lesson is mostly known as the widow's mite. I will say to call it that is, A, to make use a word that we don't use any other context anymore except that. So you almost have to interpret what's a mite. But the other thing is to miss half of the text, you know, with jumping down to the last half and missing the first half. So let's just walk through some of the issue. First of all, just widows. Notice all three of them talk to widows, and it brings up issues that in the culture in which it was written that aren't exactly our issues. Now, my mother was a widow the last 12, 13 years of her life after 50-some years of marriage, and life was economically difficult, but it wasn't economically difficult simply because she was a widow. It would have been economically difficult if my father had still been living. That had more to do with their working class life, farm life, living off Social Security, minimal pension, et cetera, et cetera. So that's, those issues are, for us are different than they were here, in which there was no social safety net. And so a widow in ancient Israeli culture was highly dependent on a male head of the household for economic security, either a husband or an adult child son who could provide, etc. So you will notice throughout the Hebrew scriptures and the New Testament, the concern for the widows, the poor, the orphans all sort of runs together. So the use of a widow in one of these stories evoked images of near destitution and desperation. Okay, so the widow of Zarephath and the widows mentioned in the psalm and the widow in the gospel all are images of someone who had almost nothing.
Right.
And without, had scraping by, eking by.
Poorest of the poor.
Poorest of the poor.
Yeah.
And then dealing with the one, the widow of Zarephath, she's also a foreigner. You know, a stranger, an alien, and that's a whole nother issue, is how do you treat the foreigner in your midst? And the Hebrew scriptures talk openly about hospitality to them, giving them hospitality. Here we have a story in which a foreigner gives hospitality to a prophet of Israel.
Who is the immigrant in this case?
Immigrant in this case.
The prophet is, yeah.
Yes. So here we go with the Zarephath story. You know, Elijah just shows up in the first verse of Kings 17. Now, 1 Kings 17, and no prelude, no introduction, none of that. And he announces to King Ahab, there's going to be a drought, except if I say not, you know, for 3 years. So he announces the drought, and now he's suffering from the drought almost immediately. And he goes out, and he has to leave. You know, this is one of those prophets against the king is not a healthy proposition. So this is one of the, you know, Elijah's either confronting or fleeing. That's his kind of modus operandi. And so he is kind of a fleeing, and he comes to this place, and the drought's already gone in. Nobody has anything. And we know this story. He says, give me a piece of bread. I got nothing. I got a little bit of oil. I got a little bit of flour. He says, make me some bread and feed me. And she says, I will die. I got nothing. We're going to eat this. And when it's gone, we got nothing. And the miracle story here, there are two miracles in this story. One miracle is the one we think about, the jar that keeps flowing and the oil until there's something else. But this other miracle is she believes him. Or maybe she doesn't believe him. She just decides to feed him because what's one more biscuit? Yeah. You know, she basically says, I got enough to make a biscuit. We're going to split it, and then we're going to lay down and starve to death. And she says, okay, you can have the biscuit. It's okay. Whatever.
Yeah.
So a miracle, but probably either the miracle is hospitality, the miracle is she believes him, or the miracle is that the jar continues to fill up until need. The question for us is, if we're dealing with this, is that whole question of trusting God And that's the core underneath this story, is not that Elijah could provoke, could do this miraculous thing, but God did this miraculous thing through him and through his promises. So as we're dealing with this, and as we look at our desperation, the real call in this text is dependence on God, which is very, very difficult. So there we have the Zarephath. I will have to say, I remember as a child going to a revival meeting, and this young man was preaching on this text, and I've never forgotten this. It was just, he said, you know, and so I was, had no money and nothing, and I prayed, and my peanut butter jar did not go empty for 2 weeks until I got a job. And he believed that God had made that peanut butter jar reproduce the same way a lot of this widow's jar of, and I hope that was true, because he did look well fed. But,
some good peanut butter in there, too.
Good peanut butter jar in there. So my only point is, don't try to create a modern miracle as a parallel story in preaching this. Just talk about how it is we are dependent on God, and you'll be fine.
Well, we love to delineate things and separate things. And as you said, you could see, you know, maybe three different forms of miracle here. The jar not running out seems to be the most, you know, evident. The fact that she believed Elijah, and okay, you've got Elijah being bold enough to say it, you know, so there's something there too. There's this miracle of hospitality. In essence, they are all part and parcel of the same miracle,
the same, all
which
the same
is miracle. The presence of God. And I would say, as we've often said, this is a gospel story. Gospel being, God is with us. And so it sort of, I won't say it begs the question, but it asks the question, is God with us or not? Right. And that's where the widow lays it on the line. Elijah lays it on the line. We are called to lay it on the line. Is God with us or not? Call it resignation. Call it faith. Call it whatever you will. If God doesn't work, if God is not with us, well, you know, that's it.
The key line is the last clause of the last verse. According to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Elijah.
Boom.
The power is the word of the Lord, and do we trust the promise or not?
That's
it. So we move into the Psalms with this praise the Lord, oh my soul. It goes there, but it's interesting as you look through the things he says, remember what to praise God for. Do not put your trust in mortals.
Mm-hmm.
Their breath departs, they return to the earth, on that their plans perish. And I was thinking, who do we praise in this world?
Yeah.
You know, we're always praising this movie stars, wealthy billionaires. I mean, going, you can come up with all kinds of celebrity lists, people who are famous for being famous, et cetera. And the scriptures have told us over and over, they die too, you know.
Yeah.
Happy are those whose help is the God of Jacob. And he goes from the princes in whom there is no help, and he comes on down executing justice for the oppressed, food to the hungry, upholds the orphan and the widows, watches over the strangers. This is a very clear delineation, this psalm, of God's upside downness that Jesus kept talking over and over. Again, the first shall be last, the last shall be first, et cetera, is rooted in Christ's understanding of the Hebrew scriptures and the mm-hmm. Hebrew faith. Mm-hmm. This is important to look at as we move to the gospel lesson. Jesus didn't come in and say, oh, no, wait a minute. We were all wrong about God. We got to supplant this Jewish. I'm Jewish, but we were wrong. You know, and Jesus didn't say that.
Right.
No, he didn't say that. He said, I did not come to abolish the law, but that in me the law might be fulfilled. And this is over and over again. This is a part of it. And the gospel lesson ties into this psalm directly as you look at both halves of the gospel lesson. So let's move to the gospel, because
let's
see, there it's a setting in Mark is chapters 11 through 13. It's in Jerusalem. A lot of it's in the temple, and Jesus is teaching, but it's not like in Matthew where you have this long sermon sections of teaching. What Mark does is he creates a lot of teachable moments. Mm. You have events that Jesus interprets, and you see this pattern over and over in Mark, in which something happens, Jesus makes a statement, and then explains it privately to the disciples. You know, there's something happens. Mm-hmm. And Jesus in Mark is the master of the teachable moment. Now, so things happen that they're observing, and Jesus uses them to further his agenda, not so much of saying that I have come to change the way in which we understand God. He said, I've come to wipe the scales away and say, this is what this is really about. One of the people that often get attacked in this, it seems an attack, is the scribes and Pharisees. You know, because you're always got the scribes or the Pharisees or a Pharisaic scribe, you know, that Jesus gets to contrast. So it's really important to know this is not all the scribes, mm-hmm. not all the Pharisees. Jesus is saying, behold, watch out for the ones who, beware of the scribes who. So it depends on where that comma goes. You know, I get in trouble for grammar. I think the comma's in the wrong place here. Because the way it's laid out in the NRSV, beware of the scribes, comma, who, so it means all the scribes. I would say you remove that comma. Beware of the scribes who, the ones who like to walk, beware of the scribes who like to walk around long strokes. Not all, mm-hmm. just the ones who do that. Mm-hmm. So I think this is important as we think about. And so one of the things you're dealing with here is that in this first section is the temptations that are inherent in power and position. That's why I think the comma is misplaced. Because I think what he's talking about is the ones that we need scribes. We need people who interpret. But there are those who let that go to their heads.
Yeah.
You know, they devour the widow's houses and for the sake of appearance say long prayers. Now, I want to tell you, one of the best things, the best seats in the synagogue, one of the best things to do when you're preaching this is to look at that and say, wow, that's, let's see, depending on your tradition.
What are you wearing today?
I probably got a long robe and I'm greeted with respect. You know, I got my collar on. I go down to Ingalls and good morning, Father, you know. And,
yeah.
And I don't know if this is the best seat, but it's mine and it's mine and nobody else sits up here. And, you know, you can play with that, you know, and places of honor and long prayers. Oh, my goodness. I've never devoured a widow's house. You know, I'm just saying that's a way into that is to talk about some, but not all, mm-hmm. and the temptations that are inherent in power and position.
Yeah. This, and just to back you up and just to back Bubba up, I know our listeners, we've got folks that have had a chance to take Greek and some who haven't and whatever. We do always have to remember when we're coming from a language like Greek and we're trying to put into English, they didn't use the commas. They didn't have punctuation marks. And so it's a judgment call here. What do you do with, these scribes who like to walk around in long robes and be greeted and with marking places? And so I think you have a valid point there. As is often the case, we are going to the attitude of the heart, not necessarily to an external expression of one's office or position or whatever. So, not that you needed me to justify that point. No. I'm just thinking.
In my position on that comma, like all good Lutherans, I'll end that with, on the other hand, I could be wrong. But there is that place. So, but what Jesus is doing here and what Mark is doing is contrasting. This is why I said it's important to keep that in mind. Contrasting an understanding of moral leadership, good leadership, for the benefit of his disciples. And so he is pointing at the scribes who walk around in long robes, and they devour and they will receive the greater condemnation. So you got this story of saying, this is not how it's supposed to be. You know, this is not how we do religious leadership. This is not how we do this. then the tie, that little bit about they devour widows' houses ties us to the second part, because we have a widow who is the contrast with these scribes. And he says, they sat down. So it's an object lesson, a visual. And they watched the crowd putting money in the treasury. I've had images, you know, it's like a big cornucopia horn, and you put the money in and it flows down in. It's kind of like, it's like putting your admission booth kind of thing. They put in their money, but, and some would wait until there was enough of a crowd that they could be seen pouring large amounts of money. And I just image the poor widow looking around and coming up and dropping her two pennies or two cents, yeah, two small copper coins, which are worth a penny. Now, notice he called the disciples a teachable moment. Now, before I talk about what he said, so often over the years, I heard this interpreted, not by Bible scholars, but by Sunday school teachers and preachers, et cetera, et cetera. Heard this interpreted, see, it's not the amount that matters. It's what your intent, it's what you give to, and so I give as much as you can. Well, I'm sorry, that's not what Jesus told about. It wasn't as much as she could. He said they gave out of their abundance. And I would argue that most give out of our abundance, even when we give a tithe, even when we consider ourselves being very generous. We sit down and we say, all right, I got to have this for taxes, and I got to have this for rent. I got to, you know, you get all of that done, and then you say, now am I able? What can I do? That's out of our abundance. Mm-hmm. He said she gave everything she had.
All she had to live on.
Everything. Now, we can say, well, that's dumb. That's foolish. That makes her dependent on the state. You know, I mean, we can find various ways, but that's not what Jesus said. She trusted. Underneath is her trust in God. Back to the widow of Zarephath. Her dependence on the love and generosity of God. And all Christian stewardship is rooted in the recognition that all that we have and all that we are is from God. And we're called upon to be generous with it. I remember people used to say, oh, you mean I have to give 10% to God? And I said, no, I mean you get to keep 90%. Isn't that great? Everything you got, God's given to you, and you get to keep 90%. John, one of the things that I have kept, one of the great ritual moments of the unritualistic Southern Baptist tradition. They say there is no ritual, but one of the great things I've kept is the intro to taking up the offering. If the ushers come forward, we will receive God's tithes and our offerings. God's tithes and our offerings, which meant it wasn't an offering till you got over 10%.
The tithe belongs to the Lord.
And anything above that is your offering. I don't know where you are with that, but I think it gets at what Jesus is talking about here about dependency. And remember, his audience is his disciples.
Right.
And they've already in Mark been talking about, we gave up everything to follow you. Remember that discussion?
Mm-hmm.
When will you come into your kingdom? We sit one at your right hand and one at your left. The great reversal, as I said, drawn out of Hebrew scriptures, is to serve the Lord is to be totally dependent and to give all you have.
Yeah.
The other person in all the way back in the widow Zarephath story that is showing total dependence on God is Elijah, who is trusting for his future on God's promise to this woman. Mm-hmm. And the woman is depending on God's promise. We are all dependent on God's promise.
Yeah.
And that underneath everything else is that sense of, to be a person of faith is to, at those risky moments, out of the poverty of that we don't have a lot to give, giving all that we have and trusting God for the future. Mm-hmm. nothing to the cross, nothing to the what I bring, but simply to thy cross I cling. And that's the core underneath it. The second core thing that I think is so vitally important not to be missed, and I've mentioned it several times through here, all of this flows with that preferential option for the poor. And we need to examine ourselves in terms of our constant sense of respect for and aspiration toward financial security, power, and influence, and reckon with and grapple with our own direction there and our willingness not only to share with those in need, but our willingness to share to such an extent that we experience that dependence on God.
Yep, absolutely. Well, you it's such a powerful text. And again, the image of the widow is so strong.
Yeah.
It overrides. And so just from the standpoint of building the sermon this day, you better save that one. You don't lead with it. Everything else you say. So we think about the setup, and you've given us a lot of great background. And absolutely, and preachers, as we're working, we're thinking of all of these things in the background. How do I want to build to it? But the image of the widow is so strong and really serves to clinch everything else that we've been trying to say. And we are all dependent, absolutely dependent, upon the grace of God. And that was true in the widow of Zarephath's story. It's true in the psalm. It's true here in the gospel text. Even by example of how not to do it, the scribes who love to do these things, the scribes who love the accolade, etc., don't realize their own dependence upon God or are not living as if to acknowledge it. So you've even got a negative example of the same point. We are all absolutely dependent on God. But yeah, be ready to really close with that story and be aware of its power. Everything else you tell on this day is basically going to drop away. You've sowed the field and you've prepared it and there you are. So
it's like we're talking about preaching, but I was thinking about Trevor Noah one night, and it was in it was a YouTube thing I saw that the between the scenes, between when there's a YouTube they do where he's talking with the audience while the commercial's going on. And one of the things he said is, it was in response to a question, he said, in true comedy, he said, the setup is the joke. He said, you set everything up and then it works. And the same thing's true of preaching. You have to set up the widow story at the end. And you set it up through issues of God's preferential option for the poor and our option to prefer other things. You set up that contrast, and then you play with this text about, well, look at this preference that Jesus is talking about. And you just have Jesus showing where we look to for power and where Christ looks for. This is for Lutherans, I have to say up front, this is a great theology of the cross story in which Luther always contrasted a theology of glory with a theology of the cross. And so the first few verses are a theology of glory. This is where we look to see God active in people who are powerful and wealthy. But really, Christ looks to the poverty. We look to Christ on the cross, God's ultimate poverty, naked and dead. This is where God is.
Yeah.
So it's one of those contrasts.
Good stuff. Right. Well, we weren't really dealing a whole lot with the Hebrews text today. And again, it's just the way it falls. Should you be referring to or even using Hebrews today? It is a great text. It's not that it's not. We've been reading some in Hebrews. You have the background of the Old Testament sanctuary, the offerings that are made in the Hebrew service. And just remember that in this marvelous sermon, this marvelous argument that is Hebrews, the writer is in all things building a case for the excellence, the surpassing excellence of Christ, not as you've been careful to point out, Delmer, in Well, all of that other stuff was crap. Now we've got
now we got Jesus.
No, it all emerges, and you get Christ the completion. And so he's in the midst of this argument. It's not a sanctuary made by humans' hands. Christ has lived and died and lives again and is now in the sanctuary of heaven. It's not a sacrifice of blood that is offered over and over. It is a sacrifice that is that is made once for all. And so Christ has now been offered once to bear the sins of many. And remember, and here's the one really nice piece that if I were working with this, I would use. He will appear a second time. Guess what we're getting ready to celebrate here in about 2 or 3 weeks?
Yeah.
We're starting again with Advent, which we need to remind ourselves is not only about getting ready for Christmas and the coming of a baby. It is about the coming again of Christ and the promise that we have been waiting on. We are the church living in the promise that is announced right here. He will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those, to complete the salvation of those who are eagerly waiting for him. So there's good stuff in the Hebrews text for today.
Yeah, that latter part, that 9:28 in Hebrews, I call as the Lutheran response to any conversation about the rapture. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. Yeah, he'll appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. It's all good news. Let's go.
So that's it. All right, Bubba, we've talked a little past our time, but it's all been good. I look forward to it. We'll see you next week. And y'all come on back, sit a spell with us. We'll talk some more text and preaching next week. But for right now, not much left for us to do other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Lock and Key by Silent Partner. We go out this session with Rock of Ages, Cleft for Me, the classic hymn by Augustus M. Toplady, performed today by the Antrim Mennonite Choir. Let me hide myself in